Brands are constantly maneuvering to take clever avenues ensuring they're seen, even when we as viewers don't fully recognize we're looking. But how exactly does effective product placement gain traction with its targeted viewership without disrupting the authenticity of the movie or episode they appear in? And how is it worth it for brands to pay copious sums of money just to have their products appear alongside filmed and even fictional characters? This is Disrupt the Market. All right, folks, episode 2, product placement, is the subject at hand. The characters, you know them, you love them, around the table. We got SEO specialist Eli Radke back at the table. Welcome.
Lovely to be back to talk about products and things.
Julia Weiss, senior copywriter, flanking him on the other side.
Oh, it's gorgeous to be here. Thanks to Diet Mountain Dew. It's crisp, it's fresh, and it gets me through even the toughest morning. Make it a great day with Diet Mountain Dew.
Product placement is so much more conspicuous on an audio podcast, but thank you for that example. Before we dive into the history, the philosophy behind product placement, let's just get the rundown, the overview. What is product placement, or as it might be less commonly known, embedded marketing? What are some of the elements of embedded marketing, Eli?
So embedded in marketing is just anytime you're watching a movie or watching a show and there's something in the background. So for instance, like a Coke can in the back of a scene of New Girl, if you're watching a refreshing show after work, or when James Bond gets out of his Aston Martin, things like that. And that's kind of when products pair with content, specifically in movies and TV shows, to feature their content in a non-commercial way. So it's less of a James Bond isn't coming out and like giving you the stats of the Aston Martin. He's just doing it. It's just there. It's living in the content.
So in essence, it's designed to get exposure in an unskippable way. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Obviously, it's not a commercial break that you can get up in.
Yeah, you're not like fast-forwarding to make sure you don't have to get sold to. It's like right there. You can't skip it. And if it's done well, you don't really even notice that it's happening. You stay engaged with the story, and you just happen to be getting that messaging that like, oh, this is a cool Aston Martin. Maybe I should purchase an Aston Martin.
And that's why, Julia, you pulled up in your fourth Aston Martin.
Yeah, I have actually. I'm getting my sixth this Thursday.
Hugely susceptible to advertising. Very troubling credit score.
So I have four Hot Wheels cars of Aston Martins. I've really splurged this month. But I think it's like when it's bad, it's bad, and everyone loves to point at a screen and be like, oh, check that out. And, you know, when something is just like not supposed to be there, but when it's good, it's really good. Because I think that the thing with embedded marketing is it's such an effective tool to find target audiences and to like market to a really large sector of people that's very interested in. If you place a product in content where it belongs, like the people who are watching that content are obviously going to be people that it's like, wow, that fits into life, that fits into what I view as, you know, kind of what I would do in my day to day. And like just that subtle placement of, oh, like, why don't you use this toothpaste or this soda, this kind of thing in your day to day. They're like, yeah, absolutely, I will.
The stigma of the phrase product placement sort of holds a lingering stink of something that's inherently false. Although the origins of product placement or embedded marketing came from a place of hyper-realized truth.
Yeah, I think the origins are honestly very organic in a variety of ways. Like in the early movie industry, which is after product placement first started being a thing, it was largely a way of like getting your set dressings and your props for free in exchange for brand exposure. Mm-hmm. And obviously that evolved into a whole industry all its own. But like originally it was just, you know, hey, let us use this for our shoot. People will see it. And the reason they knew that was going to be effective is because of those earlier instances of where product placement really got its roots. Are we ready for a history lesson? Okay. Although the term product placement was not coined until the 1980s, art and literature that predate cinema had instances of product placement.
Wait, hold the phone. Are you telling me that even before movies, product placement existed, Julia?
I'm telling you that even before movies, product placement existed. And I promised myself I would practice this French, and then I did not. So
let's just say a painting by Manet
but not
that will not be named.
Yeah. Un bar aux folies bergères.
To all listeners that speak French, désolé.
prominently features Bass beer. Now, people don't know if this was like, oh, did they pay this artist for that? Or was he just authentically depicting a scene of a bar? Which is where I think a lot of the conversation about product placement and authenticity gets like summed up because... Well, we'll get to that later. Products exist in our world, and it's weird if they're not there, but because of intellectual property and ownership, there has to be some sort of business relationship there. And that's what ends up being developed out of sort of these like early instances of product placement. The first agreement that we know of really between a brand and filmmakers was Lever soap, now known as Unilever. Maybe you've washed with it. Maybe you haven't.
Heard of it.
Yes. they befriended these French cinematic innovator brothers, which honestly, I have a crush on just that sentence. I mean, can you imagine?
So it was a pair of soap brothers, the Lever brothers.
Filmmaker brothers.
Can you imagine that table?
Really leveraging that relationship.
Okay.
Oh, do you have that loaded or was that extemporaneous?
I was
Andrew, our producer,
like
giving
that.
The cuts. Yeah, on the cutting room floor.
Someone's choking to death in the background. Weird.
But they created a short film called Washing Day in Switzerland that features two women. This is 1896, mind
100%
you.
On Rotten Tomatoes. We looked it up.
100% on Rotten Tomatoes. It's two women doing their wash outside with a box of Sunlight soap prominently featured. And this was shown at international exhibitions and hundreds of thousands of people see this.
Which for the time is pretty much all
that's basically every person on the planet. Like 700,000 people, I think, is something that I may have seen when I was researching this. Don't quote me on that. This was like a real turning point, though, because then like when Queen Victoria had her Diamond Jubilee procession, there were like partnerships for people like filming that for like the newsreels and stuff. And so that really started putting into motion what would become an actual industry around product placement.
Certainly a great allegory for the power of film, getting a couple of brothers who just want their soap to be seen in front of the queen in a few simple steps.
Yeah, a few simple steps.
Soap
you go from queen to queen.
I think this is an interesting, like, when you look at this, too, because, you know, there's so much before we knew what product placement was, there was always these products that were out there kind of creating content for themselves and kind of innovating this. And, you know, the things that stick out in our mind are always the one where, you know, in the middle of a 19, you know, an Andy Griffith show style thing, someone, like, turns to the camera and is like, and I use Lever soap because it makes my hair so clean. That's just so egregious. But you know, this like weaving the product through the content has been around forever, and that's always been the things that we talk about, and the ones that have stuck out in history are the people that have married the purpose of the content to the utility of the product.
Definitely saw some initial genius in the execution of this. Thomas Edison, known to be a pretty intelligent fellow, was known to use product placement now and again to pay off certain budgetary constraints.
Yeah, he really pioneered like the business end of like I didn't even know Thomas Edison was like a film guy. Did not know this. I was like, he invented or stole an invention of a light bulb or something. I don't know, yada yada. And then he's like the guy who makes product placement be a thing. And like because of him, it became a major part of the film industry. And as it took off, like millions of products started being sold like worldwide. It was getting an international reach. And before we had talkies, which is what we call movies today.
Thank you.
In a 1920 movie, The Garage, there was a sign for Firestone tires that was prominently featured, and Red Crown gasoline was featured consistently throughout the film on walls and on equipment. And this was controversial as, you know, we're coming from like a theater world, which has always been and Dylan and I can say this because we're from the world, a little
reformed. But yes, we can access
haughty.
That.
Haughty. And coming into like these like moving pictures, critics were like, this isn't art. You can't do this. But they did. And they continued. Wings, the first Oscar-winning film to feature product placement, had several shots of Hershey's chocolate bars, mm-hmm. including several scenes with actors enjoying them.
It was one of two Best Picture winners that year. One was verbal, one was nonverbal. I think it was the only year in which they made that distinction.
That's kind of cool.
Yeah, you can just see these two wordlessly chewing down Hershey's bars, and it was a great blend between art and commerce.
And you don't want to hear the sound of someone eating a Hershey bar.
That's true. That was generous of them to say, "We'll wait. Yeah. We'll wait one year.
Wait on this one." But I do think that like that is a super interesting, you know, piece there is just that putting stuff in there, and as product placement kind of evolved, it's, you know, it was seen as so egregious when it started, like, oh, we can't have anything in these, you know, it needs to, you know, what else would they have been chomping on, like chocolate bars with no label? I think right. It adds, when in that instance, like, you know, products do add authenticity to content, and like, you know, we don't go through life with, you know, white labeled stuff on the table, you know, drinking out of aluminum cans with a nameless green bubbly
soda.
Liquid exactly. And you know, there's always something that has, you know, we live in a world that has brands, and we live in a world that we are constantly interacting with them. You know, we make these choices daily, and that I think adds reality, like draws you mm-hmm. into the world when you're interacting with real products. And sometimes it, like, if you interact with them too much, it can throw you out of it.
Yeah, it's the finesse of like, how long does the camera linger on this? Where is it placed? Why is it placed? How is it styled? I think like they got a little smarter going into the 1930s as like huge brands started making product placement deals with all of the major motion picture studios. It became, you know, more finessed in how these things were being featured. And that's something like throughout the 20th century, we'll see there's sort of like this ebb and flow of like, you know, oh, we need to tone it down, chill out a little bit. Then it's like, oh yeah, money, so good. Yeah, we need it more.
It's a tough balance. I know we've all been there. And I know that it's not witnessing a brand in an artificial environment that mm-hmm. is disruptive. It's when it has greater emphasis than it would in the rest of the world.
Mm-hmm.
For example, in Double Indemnity, taking place in a grocery store, Green Giant had a product placement deal with the film. And mm-hmm. so all the Green Giant labels are forward facing, where all other product labels in the entire grocery store are not.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's that level of disruptive imbalance of saying, well, why is this so heavily featured when the rest mm-hmm. are taking a back seat, that would make maybe draw your eye. The idea of seeing a can of green beans on the shelf next to another labeled can would probably not pull your focus in that same way.
And then, because then you're wondering, like, who's training the stock folk at this grocery store? You're supposed to face those labels. I dated a guy who worked at Trader Joe's. Trader Joe's makes incredible products that are easy to prepare at home and satisfy the entire family.
Again, it feels a little bit more conspicuous in audio, but you're doing a great job.
But yeah, I think that's, you know, something that you got to think about. And like, certainly when you look at Double Indemnity, when you're talking about Green Giant, all that stuff, like why did they choose that? You know, and like selecting a medium for you for the product placement is very interesting, which is something that kind of we do as marketing when we look at like a competitive analysis style stuff. Like, we're not just looking at, you know, what your competitors are doing. We're looking at what a brand's kind of target market's going to be. Green Giant, for instance, you know, Double Indemnity, huge movie, establishes a brand for like, you know, I want vegetables, I know where to go. Oscar-winning film, but, you know, there are some.
A 1944 film, so thinking about, you know, the tail end of World War II, that if you needed a canned good, your pantry had to be stocked. And mm-hmm. so pulling that focus and saying that there's only one brand in a movie that popular had to have a great amount of emphasis.
Yeah.
But to your point, Eli, whether or not you're choosing to go forward with product placement, the same steps kind of take place on choosing a marketing avenue of mm-hmm. Making sure that your target market is identified, researched, and you're speaking it specifically to them, and then sourcing what your competitors are doing and trying to find an avenue therein.
Green Giant didn't know, you know, people weren't, and especially back in 1944, you know, there's not clicks, there's not KPIs, things like that. But today, you know, products can't record how many times your eyes drag across a movie screen. You have to take that chance with, you know, these, this, getting a product out to an audience and trusting that the content that you've created and the brand that you've established is like true to them. Brand identity is something that cannot be measured in, you know, exact numbers, but it's so powerful when it's there. You know, you think of like, why do you go to McDonald's? Because like you have that brand identity baked in. You know, everyone's got their favorite fast food, and that's baked into your brain because of the work that they've been doing for 20 years to brainwash you to say that Taco Bell is delicious and the best thing ever. And the Crunchwrap Supreme is on sale right now for just $5 right down the street.
Oh, that sounds great. We don't have plans for lunch.
Thank goodness. Is this not conflicting with the other brands we've already advertised for? Because otherwise I'm in. This
actually
sounds delicious.
I do think that Mountain Dew and Taco Bell are, you get that Baja Blast. It's perfect
with the
Crunchwrap.
They're in cahoots
Supreme.
For
big,
sure.
Big McDonald's is tapping on the glass right now.
Yeah, like, they're like
punching their fist into their...
Not today, McDonald's. Not today. Sliding up to the microphone is Brian Wadley.
Hello, Dylan. Nice to be here.
It's so nice to have you. Brian, not only do you serve as a partner and creative producer here at Bullseye Media, you are a cinematic vault, seeing perhaps more movies than the next three members of the Bullseye team.
I don't want to toot my own horn, but I don't have much of a personal life.
Brian, we were talking about product placement. I don't know if you were aware of this prior to showing up to the conference room. What we want to dive into are the three types of product placement that you might encounter even before you even know it's happening. What are those three categories and how do we know the difference?
Well, the three categories of product placement are screen, script, and plot. Screen is similar towards like the waffle crisp in the Seinfeld background, where it's just, it's on the screen. There's no really interaction with the characters or anything like that to the plot. And then there's the script where it's literally written into the plot, such as like the Pulp Fiction when he's talking about going to France and getting a Royale with cheese.
Now, we've already butchered the French language in this podcast, so we have to be careful. It is
Royale
with cheese.
I don't remember that happening. I remember someone doing it French good.
Well, either way, I kind of want to go to France right now to give it a try.
French McDonald's is amazing.
We also kind of disregarded McDonald's earlier, so this is a real apology tour.
On the subject on scripts written in Quentin Tarantino's, I actually just found this out last night that Denny's was supposed to be in Reservoir Dogs and Pulp Fiction. It was written into the script, but Denny's apparently didn't want anyone getting murdered or robbed or anything like that.
Or poorly tipped. If I remember that scene correctly.
You make a good point.
If I think about murder and thievery and a restaurant, my number one thought is going to be Denny's.
And that's where I go to rob.
I'm from Indiana. I know my Denny's.
Yeah, I've seen the characters at Perkins. I've never...
Oh,
that's
I
true. Our hometown hero, Perkins.
All right, then the third one is plot. And that is similar towards like the FedEx company in Castaway or the Wilson Ball. That is, it means it is integral to the plot and important to move the story forward. So it's definitely the highest price that someone would pay to get their product placed into the movie would be involved in the plot.
Beer, soda, shoes, clothing, cigarettes, and candy. Characters that we grew up with, that we know, we love, we understand, they all make these daily choices. And this became post-World War II and into the 70s and 80s when it really kind of overflowed, became branding opportunities and product placement. And to this day, I think we associate some of these categories with characters that are now iconic in our upbringings. Are there certain effective product placements that you will never disassociate from the first time that you saw them up on the big screen?
This is one of my favorite product placements, and it's actually from a guy who, starting in the 60s, he was an advertising manager in Chicago and got a call from MGM. Was like, we need a tape recorder as a prop for a movie, and that kind of like launched him into like a whole career of doing these product placement deals. His name is George Simkowski, which I feel like I know him. It's a very familiar name. He's the one who got the budget truck into Home Alone. And
That George Simkowski.
And the budget truck in Home Alone is so perfect because it's working class Polish polka band driving in the back of a budget truck down to Chicago because the flights are messed up. Like, it's so perfect for those characters. And that whole sequence is probably my favorite part of the movie. It's so beautiful. John Candy, even when he's just like in the background, it's like the best acting performance I think I've ever seen in my life. It's beautiful. I love that. And I actually, when I moved to Minneapolis, I moved in a budget truck. And there was someone else's blood in the truck, but they were really nice when I called about it.
I think that's their slogan. Brian, is there anything that stands out to you that you know has influenced your life?
Mine is kind of more on the personal on Toy Story. So I believe there are two types of people in this world. There's hustlers and people that get hustled. I am someone who gets hustled. I not only got the original Toy Story doll when I was growing up because I was the same age as Andy, but when my nephew got to that age, I went out, I bought the $80 doll that came with a certificate of authenticity because I couldn't do anything less.
There's some alarming toy sale booms that came off of the movie Toy Story. I don't know if anyone has those top of mind, but the Etch-A-Sketch really just had a resurgence. It's 400% or something like that, that it ended up going after the release of that movie?
Oh, significantly higher. The Etch-A-Sketch sold for 4,500% boost.
I'm
4,500%.
I skipped a zero there. That's incredible.
And not only that, but the Slinky, which was actually discontinued at the time, sold 20,000 units as well to the premiere of the movie.
This is sparkling in my brain of product placement in regard to children's programming. Like that, I mean, a child of the 90s, like even going back like to the 80s, I think that there are two great examples of product placement in movies geared toward kids. One, Big Time Win. One, Big Time had to make some laws, lose. Who knows the win?
It's got to be E.T. I'm seeing that finger pointed at me and it just started to glow. So that was a key indicator.
Yeah, E.T. was supposed to have M&Ms as the candy that little Elliot used to befriend the alien. Mars was like, no, but Hershey's was like, okay. Because, you know, going back to the 1920s, they know. They paid $1 million to have Reese's Pieces featured in this movie.
Because of their massive success from the Best Picture winning Wings, they just knew that this was a surefire bet.
And it really worked out. Brian, do you have the numbers on how well that worked out for E.T.?
Well, yes, I do, Julia. The E.T. sales rose 65% over the following 2 weeks.
And I think that's so effective because it's plot. It drives the plot. And it is so, and it's character driven because like a child would think, how am I going to make friends with this creature? Oh, I know. I like candy. I'll make friends with the creature through candy. It's beautiful. And it doesn't feel like we're being tricked or anything like that. It's just like beautiful. The other example is Superman 2.
A movie decidedly for children.
A movie for children that is full of Marlboro cigarettes. They even created a Marlboro cigarette truck, which did not exist because you couldn't put that on a truck because the truck would be stolen.
Absolutely. That's like a rolling Denny's at that point.
Yeah. And because of that, and it was deemed so obtrusive that there had to be restrictions put on tobacco product placements in films.
Then, I mean, product placement deals started to get even more and more complex, it felt like, that you could have competing brands against each other in a battle of good and evil. Blue Velvet, if you watch it today, is basically a three-hour phantasmic product placement for Heineken beer. Kyle MacLachlan, the protagonist of Blue Velvet, is drinking Heineken gratuitously throughout the movie, whereas Frank Booth, played, of course, by Dennis Hopper in one of the most villainous turns of all time, has some very disparaging remarks to say about Heineken beer in favor of Pabst Blue Ribbon.
What kind of beer do you like?
Heineken?
F*** that shit! Pabst Blue Ribbon!
Meanwhile, the neutral detective is a Budweiser drinker, and you can kind of choose your own adventure, but it definitely tilts the scales on how you should view the beer rankings in your classic dive bar.
Dylan, on the conversation of Heineken, who has recently rejected their drink of choice for a Heineken?
I believe I remember James Bond making that very disruptive choice Skyfall.
Disruptive for $45 million. That would disrupt.
I'd disrupt a few things too, I guess. I'd probably try a Heineken for the first time in 15 years for $45 million.
Heck, I might smile too.
Yeah, James Bond is, I mean, an iconic character through the ages. You associate him with certain brands, product, that type of brand allegiance. Why is it important that a character, a fictional character, stays authentic to the choices that we know him to make over the course of several casting changes and multiple decades of...
Because people tend to be incredibly loyal to brands. I was just reading about, like, generics. and how a lot of, you know, brands will also make like a basically the same thing as a store brand or generic brand, exactly the same or similar and less expensive. And people can even be fully intellectually aware of it, but just like, no, I'm like, brand loyalty is a huge thing. I think that, you know, living in a capitalist society, these things all play an important role in our identities. So when we see an iconic character who makes an iconic choice because he is iconically loyal to a drink, switch it up for a beer that, like, your mom is upset your dad got for the 4th of July, it is jarring.
Talking about the three types of product placement, bringing it back to that, it does seem like in escalating scale, just seeing it is entry level. Sure, it's incidental. Having it mentioned puts it in front of you all the more and thus has now a higher price point. If you can ingrain that into part of the plot to have some sort of emotional tie or story development surrounding that product, it's the most highly effective and probably the highest price. And somehow it seems that Tom Hanks is always circulating the most effective version of plot-based product placement. I know we've got a couple examples, but FAO Schwartz, we've got the big dance on the giant keyboard. You've got Mail, he and Meg Ryan using this interface alongside of us, sort of showing us as a tutorial like how it actually works.
Yeah.
And really eliminating all of the scary byproducts that came with the Wild West of that chat room lifestyle.
The Woody doll.
The Woody doll. He's the reason you bought this certified.
And it comes back around.
Oh my gosh, Tom Hanks is...
We trust him.
He should be on money, and the only person on money.
Just on any bill denomination.
Globally.
Highly confusing.
Larry Crown got me to buy a Vespa.
I think that the Vespa is a great example of product placement. That movie doesn't exist without that Vespa, and it probably shouldn't exist anyway. I would argue, I'm going to bring to the table, perhaps the most emotionally stirring yet conspicuously obvious product placement that I can think of is the character of Wilson in Castaway. Mm-hmm. I think this is a deal gone wrong. Originally, mm-hmm. Wilson was written in as Spalding in the script. Spalding couldn't reach an agreement. Screenwriter makes a change, makes a deal with Wilson, names the antagonist of the film Dr. Spalding in sort of retaliation. And now we have Tom Hanks, America's trusted father, screaming Wilson as he floats away. And our loyalty has forever remained with that volleyball.
Mm-hmm.
Still crying.
I fell asleep for most of that movie, but cried at that part.
Well, it's one of the six lines, I think, in the whole movie. So I see why that would have woken you up, you know, that you get lulled into the silent film that is him trying to figure out how to bust a coconut. And then
my only takeaways are you can remove your own tooth with a blade. You can form a deep bond with a volleyball. And you can trust FedEx.
Oh, yeah. It's not even the strongest product placement in the whole movie.
Your FedEx delivery person can be stranded on an island for literal years, and they will still make it their beeswax to get you your item.
So why would we rather see Tom Hanks go to great lengths to A, survive, and B, deliver your FedEx package, rather than be sold directly by FedEx and say, we would love to be your carrier of choice? Why do we hate being sold to, knowing that we are always being sold to?
Our young nation has a lot of cynicism woven into the very fabric. And we are always trying to figure out, is there an agenda? What's your agenda? Can I trust you? We don't like feeling like someone has an agenda. And so when product placement is the most effective, there's not a clear agenda. It's leveling. It's either you've got like the Wayne's World thing where they like call out product placement and you're on their level and it's like, okay, you know what? This is hilarious. I will get some Pizza Hut and some Reeboks because they're calling it out and they're not treating me like I'm stupid. And then you have where it's just human beings that are like you who are engaging with brands the way you do. And if it's a brand that you have some nostalgia for, like in Stranger Things, Eleven and the Eggos, like that's really effective because it resonates in an honest emotional way. It makes sense and it feels true. We just want things to feel true. We don't want to feel like someone's tricking us.
Nostalgia plays a huge factor in influence because it will permeate into the viewer's memory and trigger response. It's why we still see Jim Carrey dusting off the Cable Guy character for this year's Super Bowl commercial. It makes someone remember a time and thus connect them to this product. So there is that level of nostalgia as influence. And then, Julia, to your other point of needing to be speaking the truth or transparency, I might apply that to today's influencer movement. How are influencers or reality stars sort of pulling back the curtain, even though by design this is the same conceit of showing someone using a product and then likening yourself to that person?
I feel like influencers are not yet good enough actors to act like they really use and enjoy the product a lot of the time. Like the best influencers, you have a sense of like genuine excitement for them, but otherwise it's like influencer voice.
At its best, Brian, how does product placement avoid that level of inauthenticity in order to convince us that the character using the product is like us?
I mean, to avoid is definitely to avoid holding the can up to your face while smiling and talking about the attributes. But to bring it in is to, the story creates the problem and then the product solves the problem. It is the Bond needs to get somewhere. He doesn't take a Vespa, even though that would probably be pretty cool. He takes an Aston Martin. James Bond can't go anywhere without his Aston Martin. I guess that is effective product placement. To be honest, I'm not going to go out to buy an Aston Martin.
Julia's already got four.
I can let you borrow one.
But establishing a need within the truth, that seems to be the way forward in effective product placement.
Absolutely.
So with all of this that we've discussed in mind, is product placement good for us? Is it bad? Is it just a neutral aspect of art in the commercial world that we've grown to accept? Is it more distracting to have a box say cereal on it rather than the brand name? Where does product placement fit in the level of authenticity in all of the media that we're consuming?
I think that it is necessary to have real brands featured in any film or television that takes place in the actual world. Like, it's, I think, essential for realism as a form. It is a real give and take between storytellers, screenwriters, and the movie industry, the TV industry, and like the industries of these brands to work together to honor the story, allow things to be used in an authentic way, and to trust the artists to do it well. Because if you have only the money people making the choices, that's when you get into a bright, shiny Hyundai in The Walking Dead apocalypse. You need to have the storytellers guiding the way for it to feel good.
Life happens around brands, and we need that honesty in like content. Cereals or sodas or cars, things like that, they need to have that, you know, we as consumers have an emotional connection with these brands already, and to not have them in there is not to create true media. So I don't think that the content can exist without the product anymore. We've come to a part where, like, if we're going to make art about life, there better be aspects of life in that art. If you want quality content, you need something that the viewer is going to interact with every day.
With that in context, how does that allow us as marketers to explore new mediums, stories, and avenues to get brands in front of people authentically?
Well, I think that when you look at when stories first had, you know, product placement, everyone was running around with their hair on fire, like, this is the end of art. It's, you know, all integrity has gone out the window and there's nothing we can do. And now we have, you know, sci-fi in the future, like, expects us to just have branding constantly thrown at us. And I don't think that's the future. I think we will continue to develop the ways that we interact with life and with products and with media, and we will continue to find ways to organically work that in. And there are those people who are going to do it really well, and you're like, wow, that's incredible. And like, you're going to remember those commercials, you're going to remember those movies, you're going to remember those TV shows. And there are going to be people that do it comically, and it's going to be, you know, a meme or the next, you know, video of bad advertisements. And you want to make sure that you're in the right column of that versus the wrong column.
I come from a comedy background, and our whole thing in like the live performance of comedy in Chicago was to play to the height of your intelligence and to trust your audience. People are not dumb. The world would completely completely fall apart instead of just kind of fall apart if people were not kind of smart. And you have to trust that even if they don't get the entire thing, they'll get enough of it. Being creative and telling stories in new ways and not defaulting to what we know kind of works, because when you do that, you make a copy of a copy of a copy and it gets inauthentic really quickly and it becomes predictable and it becomes annoying and people are smart enough to know that that's stupid and that they're being sold to in a way that feels gross. If you are engaged with how people think and feel and make stories and silly things or beautiful things that appeal to some other part of the brain other than their wallet, then that's going to be effective.
Our team has experience across creative mediums in speaking for your brand in a voice that invites and engages with your target audience while subverting expected tropes. To get started on making a lasting impression with your target audience, contact us. Let's have a conversation. This has been Disrupt the Market.